Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, David Hume, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 2.
As we've seen, most of Hume's contemporary readers didn't really understand his radically new philosophy. He wanted to show them that solving practical problems requires us to solve underlying theoretical controversies. While many readers didn't understand this, both appreciative readers and critics did see that Hume's philosophy had radical political and religious consequences. To understand him, let's begin by discussing Hume's history of England. In the light of the history, we can better understand his preferred political and economic policies. We can then understand his ethical theory on which his policies are based. The ethical theory will then set the stage for discussing Hume's religious views and the philosophical fundamentals of his work. Another way of saying all this is that we're proceeding through Hume's works from the practical to the theoretical. The overall reason for doing this is that Hume's philosophy emphasizes practical concerns rather than theoretical ones. Let's turn to Hume's history of England. As a result of the great political upheaval of the 17th century, Great Britain found herself at the beginning of the 18th century with a new constitutional arrangement. It had a limited monarchy, two political parties, Whigs and Tories, and new social and economic liberties. These were unprecedented liberties for the English, and Hume explored how to preserve them in what he called this new plan of liberty. Neither Whigs nor Tories had a coherent plan to protect their new freedom. Both parties adopted dogmatic positions to justify their roles in the earlier revolution. They still fought the old verbal battles. They saw no need to reconstruct political institutions and political rhetoric. Hume thought that the best place to begin a reform was to correct the historical record and then to determine the implications for future practice. After reading previous historical accounts, Hume was convinced that a major obstacle to Britain's political reconstruction was a mythical English history being promoted by the Whigs. They'd argued that there was a continuous ancient constitution of which the Magna Carta of 1215 was only one expression. They declared that this ancient constitution codified the rights and liberties of Britons. They also claimed that the Stuart kings, James I and Charles I, had violated the rights of Britons by expanding the royal prerogatives. Hume said this history was mostly myth. To begin with, there'd been no ancient constitution. Law and political organization had simply evolved into its current state.
The English constitution, like all others, has been in a state of continual fluctuation.
Hume documents four distinct periods of British history. He shows that in the earlier periods, Britons did not enjoy anything like modern liberty. This developed much later. He shows that the Stuart kings, James I and Charles I, had claimed no prerogatives beyond those established by the Tudor monarchs, Henry VIII and Elizabeth. According to Hume, even if the early Stuarts responded ineptly to new circumstances, and however unacceptable their theory of divine right might have been, the Stuart practices were no different from the practices of the Tudors. Finally, Hume attacks the Whig theory that there's a right to revolution. He says this theory is self-defeating. Rights are not meaningful unless some authority is recognized to preserve them. And meaningful criticism of a tradition or practice can only come from within that practice. Any attempt to stand outside of a practice or tradition and to criticize it, as if the critic is a totally disengaged observer, is doomed to incoherence. This notion is a hallmark of Hume's thinking, that criticism can only be internal, that it never can be done from an external or utopian viewpoint. It's easy to understand how Hume's history offended the revolution-minded Whigs. In the second volume of the history, Hume blasted the later Stuarts for failing to recognize that revolution had brought changes in the British Constitution. The Stuarts should have recognized the new set of circumstances, or what Hume calls the new plan of liberty. Ironically, according to Hume, Britain's new liberties had resulted inadvertently from disturbances created by the religiously fanatic Puritans. He supported this new political order, thereby offending the other main political faction in England, the conservative Tories. Hume sought to strike a balance between the Whigs and the Tories. The Whigs had introduced a new social and political order, which, in retrospect, had been liberating. The Tories insisted that preserving liberty requires a strong emphasis on loyalty and obligation.
in the particular exertions of power, the question ought never to be forgotten, what is best? But in the general distribution of power among the several members of a constitution, there can seldom be admitted any other question than, what is established? The only rule of government which is intelligible or carries any authority with it is the established practice of the age and the maxims of administration which are at that time prevalent and universally assented to.
Hume drew a number of political conclusions from his history. First, there's a constant social and political tension between liberty and authority.
In all governments, there is a perpetual intestine struggle, open or secret, between authority and liberty. And neither of them can ever absolutely prevail in the contest.
Rather than making liberty an absolute value, Hume reminds us that liberty must be protected by an established authority. This is the role of government and the due process of law. Hume's second political conclusion is to advocate checks and balances in government. When James Madison later wrote the 10th Federalist Paper to defend the new U.S. Constitution, he incorporated Hume's arguments that divided government power can avert the dangers of competing social and economic factions. Hume and Madison believed that the chief executive should have power to counterbalance the power of the legislature. Hume saw the chief danger to liberty in the abuse of legislative power when various interest groups seek to have laws passed for their private advantage. Members of the legislature are elected by a local constituency, so they're much more vulnerable to special interest pressure than a chief executive, who represents the total national interest. 200 years later, we still grapple with the same problem. Hume's third political conclusion is that a free market economy is the chief safeguard of political liberty. This free economy includes private property, market exchange, and the sanctity of contracts. Hume insists that rising commerce spurred the growth of English liberty. Members of the new commercial middle class were and are the most reliable defenders of liberty.
It is the best and firmest basis of public liberty, because such men covet equal laws which may secure their property and preserve them from monarchical as well as aristocratical tyranny. Progress in commerce and the arts has a natural tendency to preserve, if not produce, a free government.
Hume's conservative political conclusions aroused the suspicions of Thomas Jefferson, who feared the return of conservative Toryism in American thinking. So Jefferson, while President of the United States, tried to influence publishers to reproduce an abridged version of Hume's history, written and edited by John Baxter. Jefferson later attempted to have Baxter's history replace Hume's original work in the Library of the University of Virginia. Despite his belief in free speech, Jefferson found it possible to defend this alteration of Hume's work.
Baxter has performed a good operation on Hume's history. He has taken the text of Hume as his groundwork, abridging it, and wherever he has found him endeavoring to mislead, by either the suppression of a truth or by giving it a false coloring, he has changed the text to what it should be, so that we may properly call it Hume's History Republicanized.
David Hume's economic philosophy is found in his Political Discourses, published in 1752, and in his Essays and Treatises on Several Subjects, published in 1753. Hume deals primarily with five economic issues: money, interest rates, the rise of commerce, the balance of trade, and the national debt. Hume's economic philosophy follows the same general pattern as his history. He describes how some general features about human nature are modified by particular historical circumstances. So, to understand economic institutions, we must examine their natural history. The result is Hume's evolutionary account of the rise and progress of commerce. According to Hume, individuals are driven by the desires for action, liveliness, and pleasure. The desire for gain or wealth reflects these more fundamental drives. Since action is fundamental to human nature, Hume emphasizes action in explaining economic activity. He also justifies the free market economy by pointing out its ability to satisfy human wants. Commerce and trade are positive social ways of satisfying those wants. Hume's theory of economic growth also says that the political liberty in free societies is caused by two things: their individualism and the private nature of their economies. He further explains that individualism and private economies came about with the decline of feudalism and the rise of commercial societies. The great economic controversy of Hume's day was between mercantilists and free traders. Mercantilists measured a country's wealth by its total money stock. They wanted a positive balance of trade, along with legal restrictions to ensure a trade surplus. Hume opposed mercantilism, arguing that free trade increases the real wealth of all countries involved. Economic growth in one country stimulates economic development in neighboring countries. Resources become more efficiently allocated and new technologies are developed. Wealthier foreign countries stimulate demand for goods of all kinds, including imports. Hume challenges the fundamental assumption of mercantilism, namely that wealth consists of gold. On the contrary, wealth consists of goods and labor.
Money is none of the wheels of trade. It is the oil which renders the motion of the wheels more smooth and easy. It appears that want of money can never injure any state within itself, for men and commodities are the real strength of any community.
Hume argues that low interest rates result not from an increase in the money supply, but from increased savings.
The interest rate is the barometer of the state, and its lowness an almost infallible sign of prosperity. The reduction in the rate of interest results from the increase of industry and frugality of arts and commerce.
Hume had an enormous influence on economic theory. A century later, J.H. Burton praised his discussion of economic issues.
"These discourses are, in truth, the cradle of political economy."
Hume's closest friend, the economist Adam Smith, published his classic book, The Wealth of Nations, in 1776. It's difficult to imagine how he could have done it without being stimulated by Hume's arguments. In that great book, Smith himself acknowledges the influence of Hume. Are there still lessons to learn from Hume's economic writings? Listen to him warn about national debt and inflation for a rich economy. That is, an economy whose labor and products obtain high prices by world standards.
"In general, we may observe that the dearness of everything from plenty of money is a disadvantage which attends an established commerce and sets bounds to it in every country by enabling the poorer states to undersell the richer in foreign markets. This has made me entertain a great doubt concerning the benefits of banks and paper credit. That provisions and labor should become dear by the increase of trade and money is in many respects an inconvenience. But there appears no reason for increasing that inconvenience by a counterfeit money, which foreigners will not accept in payment, and which any great disorder in the state will reduce to nothing. Our modern expedient is to mortgage the public revenues, and to trust posterity will pay off the encumbrances contracted by their ancestors. The practice of contracting debt will almost infallibly be abused by every government. Either the nation must destroy public credit, or public credit will destroy the nation."
This is the end of part 2. Please download part 3 to continue.